In his new book, The Jewel, Neil Hegarty brings us into the nefarious world of art, forgery and robbery, as well as giving us a heist story. The Jewel explores why promising artists turn their talent to copying the works of others and asks, is art like beauty in the eye of the beholder? Or can art, in fact, be created never to be viewed? With me in studio to tease out some of those ideas is creator of The Jewel, Neil Hegarty. I was talking to you before we came to air. I was boasting today that you were inspired to write this book in Monaghan because I saw that you were on a bus from Derry to Dublin. You've just shattered it all on
Neil. Sorry.
You were, in fact, in the Glenshean Pass when the idea came to you.
I was indeed.
On your way over to Belfast from Derry.
I'd been in Derry for the weekend. I was travelling back to Dublin via Belfast. So I was a captive audience on the bus and reading a paper about an art exhibition, the Beyond Caravaggio, which you might remember. I was on at the National Gallery of Ireland a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it was on in London, I think, at the end of 2016 and then early 2017 here.
Yes, and it was one of these big blockbuster exhibitions. Mm. And I was reading it and I thought, I must go and see this. I think everybody in Ireland feels some sort of kinship to Caravaggio as a result of the taking of Christ, the famous Irish Caravaggio, as we can call it, which was discovered in Mason Street. Found, just sitting on a wall. And that was an amazing story. So I think Irish ears probably pop up whenever Caravaggio is mentioned. And I was reading this piece and I began thinking about the intricacies of staging such a vast exhibition, all these priceless pieces of art. And then I thought, I wonder how easy it would be to steal one of these paintings. Not that I was intending to do it.
How quickly did that thought come to your mind? Can I steal one of these?
Yes, let's see how hard this is. And it was one of those light bulb moments. Mm. I had an idea. The novel came into my head, the beginning, the end, lots of the middle. And I thought, let's see where this goes. I had to do some basic research.
Yeah.
I had to see.
Let me just ask you about your own kind of knowledge of the art world. I know that you lived at some point in some part of Dublin where you walked through the National Gallery on your maybe on your way to work or wherever you were going during the daytime, and you'd stop there for a little moment for yourself.
I lived 5 minutes for years and years. I lived 5 minutes walk from the National Gallery, and because it's free, because the art inside it belongs to all of us. And because it has a handy entrance on Merrion Square and another handy entrance on Clare Street, I got
the
habit.
Which is the route you had to take.
Which is the route I had to take. Yeah. So I got in the habit of going into the building on a regular basis, stopping for 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes to look at paintings here and there. That's where I got my first attraction, you might say, to Caravaggio. Mm. And it all went from there. I have no academic training in the visual arts. I don't know one side of a paintbrush from the next. But I gradually lost any sense of fear I might have about paintings. I had also worked on an art history project. I had sort of ghostwritten a book for Jeremy Paxman some years ago on Victorian paintings. So I had a level of understanding of art there as well, but very much it was a lay person's understanding.
And when you were going through the gallery at that point, was it purely spontaneous, the choice of painting that you would sit in front of for the 5 minutes? Did you just, whatever one caught your eye on the day?
Whatever one caught my eye, the Jack B. Yeats, the material upstairs where the rooms are much quieter and the paintings tend to be much bigger. I just went and looked. I feel quite strongly, quite passionately really, that because these paintings all belong to us, because they're part of the National Gallery, that anybody can feel as though they should do that. They can do that. They can just go and look at a painting and see, does this painting speak to me? What does it say? Let's just listen, let's just look, let's just have a good gaze for a few minutes and see what happens.
I love the fact that you use the word listen, actually. You talk about that. Sit down in front of the painting and let the conversation, like you would if you were meeting somebody, it doesn't necessarily all happen in the first sentence. You have to kind of let the conversation grow.
Yeah, just gaze at it, let it come alive in front of your eyes, and they do. And you know, it can be realistic, it can be some piece of modern art, but they all have messages that they wish to convey, which is a great feeling. It's a great idea,
and obviously fed directly into the writing of this novel, and also the Jeremy Paxman experience fed into a specific detail in this novel, where you know, Donna Tartt had her painting for the Goldfinch. It was there. There was an actual painting that she could base this arc. She could, you know, describe for the story. You invent the painting. You invent the jewel. You invent the artist.
Yes.
But she is a Victorian artist, which is the period you had researched for the Jeremy Paxman book.
Yeah, so I was comfortable with the Victorian period and I like Victorian writing. And I've always been aware of the amount of painters and writers whose stories don't get told. Mm. So even though this artist who I named Emily Sanborn, she's an English artist, she doesn't exist and the painting doesn't exist, it was relatively straightforward to bring her to life as a neglected artist who didn't get the space and the kind of adulation that her talent should have brought her.
Yeah, the pejorative you've heard, and I think one of the characters in the book uses this at one point as well, talks about a lady painter. A lady painter of the Victorian era.
And there was so much of that. And writers too. You know, women's stories just don't get told. That's beginning to change now, but certainly in the Victorian period, they didn't get told. They didn't get told in the same way as men's stories do.
So you had to imagine this painting into being, but the way you describe it at times in the book, it almost sounds like a Caravaggio.
Yes.
The artist herself puts herself into the painting as well, but there's a description of holding up a lantern and, you know, the light coming across very much in the style of a Caravaggio. That was in your mind, clearly.
Yes, when I imagine the jewel from the very beginning, I always imagined it as a composition of light and darkness in the way that Caravaggio works. And if you'll remember again, the taking of Christ, there's Caravaggio at the back holding his lantern. So I stole that particular detail. But I never describe it in its totality in the novel. I allow or encourage the reader to take the painting and imagine it for themselves. It's a kind of like a gift, which is nice.
And there's a touch of that thing you say about when you were going through the National Gallery on that walk of yours on a daily basis. It's allowing the space for that to happen.
So exactly.
The reader has to, I don't say when the reader has to do a bit of work, but you're actually saying, no, you can make this painting up in your head. And
anyone can.
Yeah.
Anyone can. Anyone.
You don't have to be an art expert to do it.
You absolutely don't have to be an art expert. And in fact, it's probably better because you have the freedom. Mm. You're not operating within any constraints. Mm. You just let your imagination play. And that's what I wanted people to do as they imagine this painting in my book as well.
So far, so good. And, you know, we're in a nice, gentle world of Victorian art, albeit a neglected painter in this case. But we're in a world where art is stolen and art is forged and, you know, fake copies are made. What brought you into that aspect of the world? I think, in fact, I saw you saying something, you know, when you mentioned the Caravaggio story earlier on, you know, the whole question often comes up when you're talking about novels. How plausible is this story?
Yes.
You know, how ridiculous, how much are you asking us to believe? But of course, if you're told, oh yeah, there's been a Caravaggio hanging on a wall in Dublin, you'd be like, ah, come on.
Yeah.
You wouldn't believe it.
You wouldn't believe it. I did some research because I wanted to make sure that this novel would be well-founded, that people wouldn't go, oh, this could never happen. And honestly, 5 minutes on Google showed me that there's no such thing as unbelievable in the art world.
What was the most outrageous or the thing that you read in that scenario where you thought, that can't have happened, but it did happen?
It's an incredibly competitive field, but the story which comes to mind, which I almost couldn't believe, concerns an art heist, a spectacular art heist in the 1990s at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Gallery in Boston, which is very glitzy and very, very, very glamorous gallery.
And you would have thought very secure.
You would think extremely
and
secure.
They would be very careful about who comes in and out.
You'd like to think so. In fact, what happened there was that some thieves dressed up as cops rolled up to the front door of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum Gallery in the middle of the night, and they knocked on the door. They said to the security guards, it's the cops, let us in. And it wasn't an inside job. The security guards let them in. They were tied up, and the thieves spent the rest of the night going through the collection in the gallery, taking as many of the old masters, the priceless old masters from the walls as they wanted, including Rembrandt's priceless paintings. They took, I think, about 15 of them. And they've never been seen since. They've never been traced. You have to assume they were stolen to order because they couldn't be they couldn't be resold on the open market.
Yeah. So just to link this into to the book, The Jewel, so that we don't, you know, that people don't think, why are they talking about art? So Emily, your fictional Victorian painter made a painting that she wanted and did bring to the grave with her.
Yes.
And she wanted it to stay with her. She didn't want it to go anywhere
yes.
else. She wanted it to stay there. But her relatives had different
family.
Ideas. Yeah.
Yes, her descendants got wind that this was a story, that there was something in the grave with her. Mm. She was exhumed. The painting was taken. It was sold on the open market. And it found its way to a gallery in Dublin, which is not unlike the National Gallery. It's a fictionalized version of our own National Gallery.
Yeah.
And there it hung for years and years until it began to achieve a certain fame. And when the story opens, it's the most famous painting in the gallery. The gallery itself has just opened after a major refit, and everybody is dying to see this painting.
Oh, it sounds too real, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Indeed. Mm. And because the gallery is still at sixes and sevens, the thieves decide, okay, now is a moment to take this piece and get it out of Dublin and story kicks off from
and
there.
And in case anybody's getting any ideas, the National Gallery is totally secure and it was well secured during all those renovations
yes.
for just such eventualities, let us be clear. But you mentioned something there, Neil, that I think is quite interesting, this idea that things are stolen to order. Now, if you get one of these, you know, the Isabella Gardner place, a gallery in Boston, or indeed this fictional jewel, which everybody was dying to see, such a painting. If you get one of those, you're not going to be able to sell it and make money. So what do you think is the motivation for those who commission thieves to take paintings like this?
It's the magpie instinct that I think a lot of us probably have about smaller objects. We like to collect things. I think, I know there are oligarchs and wealthy people and all sorts of people in this world who want certain pieces. So the word goes out, they want this piece. They know it can never be exhibited. It's stuck in a safe. It's stuck in a strong room in America or Russia or the Gulf. And that's it. Its story ends. Mm. And it's a terrible thought because these paintings, they may not have our names on them, but just, it's part of our cultural heritage.
I just want to touch briefly on one other aspect of the story, which is there are three characters who are involved in the art world. One of them, a man who was born in Deptford and kind of saw that suburb of London fall apart and they
yes.
were moved out elsewhere. Another one, a young woman, an Irish woman, 70s, 80s, and a difficult experience around pregnancies, etc.
yes.
within the family in that period in time. And another a guy who's kind of an art finder, if you
yes.
like, he's the detective of the piece in some ways, who's a gay man in a very difficult relationship, a
yes.
relationship that a toxic relationship
yes.
is the only way you could describe it. How important is that, the social realities there, to this story itself, which was to the fore for you, the art aspect or those social realities? And I've only given you 20 seconds to answer that.
I think the social realities, each of those three stories that you mentioned, they are all highly believable. We may not have experienced these difficulties ourselves, but we know people, all know people who've experienced something of the sort. So my idea was that these stories would chime very strongly with every reader.
Yeah, and the authenticity that's involved in forgeries and in art, making it all fits into finding yourself the authentic life.
Exactly. You have to do that.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's a lot of reading in the book, and indeed enjoying the interview with NP Hegarty at the moment. Is one of our tweets coming with me on my trip to the West next week. Well, hope you enjoy it, Paula McGrath, and all of the rest of you that want to get it. Neil Hegarty's The Jewel is published by Head of Zeus.